Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Commissioner of Internal Revenue against Portland Cement Company. I think you may proceed when you're ready, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This income tax case here comes here on a writ of certiorari from the United States Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit. The questions involve an application of a well-established formula method set out in the regulations for more than 40 years for measuring the gross income from mining of a taxpayer who mines and thereafter produces a finished manufactured product, the so-called integrated miner manufacturer. The object of the formula, which is called the proportionate profits method, is to determine the price at which the taxpayer would have sold his mined ore to itself in a hypothetical sale so as to confine the depletion deduction to its intended purpose of compensating for the exhaustion of the mineral deposit. The depletion deduction is a fixed percentage of gross income from mining. The method, the proportionate profits method, is employed, as it was in this case, where there is no representative field price or sales of actual sales at the cutoff point, at the point in which the mining activity ceases, or where there is essentially at arm's length. And the underlying theory of the proportionate profits method, which is a cost ratio method, which is set out in our brief at page three, it's a formula which essentially multiplies a fraction, the numerator of which is mining costs over total costs, that is mining plus non-mining costs, times the gross sales of the first marketable product, which here is finished Portland cement, and that figure.
Can I ask you right there gross sales figure? That is the actual. That isn't a constructed figure, is it?
No.
That is
no.
An actual figure representing the sales price of the finished product, whatever that product is.
Exactly. Exactly.
Of the first marketable product.
Of the first marketable product.
And so that if it normally that price would be enough to cover all costs anyway.
Yes.
Or they'll go broke.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's the gross sales price.
Exactly. And the theory of the underlying theory of the method is that each dollar of costs earns its proportionate share of gross sales and thereby of profits. And the questions in this case are two, and they involve both involve detailed applications of the method. The first question is whether the gross sales figure, that is the multiplier, of the first marketable product includes bulk and bagged cement, as the regulations require, or whether, as respondent contends, simply bulk cement. And the second question involves the denominator of the fraction, that is the total cost, and whether that denominator should include costs of bags, bagging, storage, distribution, and sales should be included as the regulations require.
Well, the two questions are separate. They're They're interrelated, are they?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, they have to kind of be answered the same way consistently.
Exactly.
So you couldn't lose the first question and still change the denominator, could you?
No.
Well, the questions are interrelated. I think
if your first marketable product is bulk cement,
right,
you're certainly not going to include in the denominator the cost of bagging.
No.
Exactly.
No. The facts.
On the tax, his tax return, did the taxpayer, with respect to gross sales costs and office administrative costs, did the taxpayer seek to exclude them entirely or to place some of them in the numerator?
My understanding is that he sought to exclude them entirely. That's basically the position. That's basically the position of the court below, which, as we set forth in our petition and our brief, has been out of line with not only the regulations but with all the other courts of appeals.
Does the taxpayer take a different position on that than it did in the court below?
I think so. My understanding in looking at the briefs now is the taxpayer is seeking a prorated approach.
Mr. Smith, if the court below had agreed with you that the first marketable product was both bulk and bag cement, I'm not sure it would have excluded any cost from the denominator.
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, I can't.
Well, I know, but it said that the first marketable product was bulk cement.
Yes, so it more or less.
Which event you should throw out some costs from the denominator.
Yes, and they said.
So
your
first question, if you went on the first question, you.
I think we went on the first question as a logical matter. The second question is a subsidiary question which takes care of itself. But it's hard to know exactly how the court below felt about this question generally, because it had this question has been kicking around in the Tenth Circuit ever since it's the ideal basic.
But there's no suggestion that they would throw those costs out of the denominator even if.
No.
Even if the first marketable product is bag
cement. What the Tenth Circuit has said, which we take strong disagreement with, is that the first marketable product was bulk cement. But let me just simply sketch out the facts, which are relatively simple.
Which do they sell most of, by the way?
They sell mostly bulk cement. The bag cement accounts for about 7 or 8% of its 7 or 8. Let me put it this way. The cement in bags, it's the same product. It's whether it's sold in a railroad car or whether it's packed in bags pursuant to a particular kind of customer demand for cement in bags. The facts are relatively simple. This respondent, like all others in the cement industry, is an integrated minor manufacturer of Portland cement. The mining process involves a quarrying and a digging of this cement rock. It's a calcium carbonate kind of rock. It's reduced in size. It's then ground to a high degree of fineness. Water is added to produce something called a slurry. And then that slurry is stored in tanks and agitated to maintain uniform mixture until such time as it passes to the manufacturing process.
Smith, is it agreed that the mining phase stops at the point where slurry is.
Yes, I think that is agreed because the mining process and Congress has ratified this in Section 613(c)(4)(f), which was enacted in response to the court's Cannelton decision. The mining process stops at the kiln feed. Everything after that is non-mining. And then this liquid slurry, as I've adverted, is then fed into these rotary kilns, which are fired, and a hard substance called a clinker is ultimately formed. That clinker is cooled, ground up with purchased gypsum to produce the finished cement. And then there's a final grinding, and then the finished cement is stored in silos. Some of the cement is sold in bulk in tank cars or piggyback or gondola cars, a variety of different forms for large consumers that need cement in that kind of quantity. But the important thing is that cement has to be kept dry. Otherwise, it becomes wet, it becomes worthless. So some people don't need that much cement, and for those customers, this manufacturer, as well as all others in the integrated industry, pack the cement in bags of a, which are a standard 94-pound weight, as I understand.
Mr. Smith, I suppose it never happens, but suppose this manufacturer sold everything in bags. Would you have a different case?
We'd have a different case, but I don't think there would be a quarrel. I mean, essentially, it would be the same marketable product. In our view, it would still be cement. The bagging costs would be a cost of sale, and we would contend that that would be that would have to go into the denominator, and the bagging premium
would take the same position that he does.
Right,
here.
But I assume that this taxpayer couldn't really argue that anything else was a first marketable product.
It had nothing to do with this case at all. But what's the difference between concrete and cement?
Concrete, as I understand it, and I should know this because I'm a city boy, I think is what happens when the cement is, put in the building and hardens. I think you talk about a concrete sidewalk. I don't think you talk about a cement sidewalk. But I could be wrong on that. this taxpayer, the respondent, computed its gross income from mining in accordance with the proportionate profits method. Indeed, it had to because, as I said, there is no representative field price, and it did not sell, nor did anyone in this industry, sell kiln feed. So there's no way to know how much kiln feed would sell for. But contrary to the command of the regulations, and I have to emphasize that these regulations, which are set forth in detail in the appendix to our brief, are detailed and more or less preempt this area and preempt it in accordance with a command of Congress in Section 611A that the Commissioner promulgate such regulations, the respondent computed its gross income by excluding bagged cement from the computation and by excluding the costs of bagging, storage, distribution, and sales from the total costs element in the formula, the so-called the denominator in that fraction. The tax court in this case upheld the respondent because the tax court has a rule in which it will follow the relevant circuit to which a case will go, the so-called Golson rule. And since this Court of Appeals had already expressed itself in the ideal basic case, that's why the tax court held the way it did, and the Court of Appeals followed its ideal basic decision. Now, in our view, with respect to the first question, the respondent's first marketable product is finished cement, regardless of the form of packaging. As I said, the theory of the proportionate profits method is that each dollar of cost produces the same percentage of profits. To exclude any costs or any element of any aspect of gross sales received in production or sale of the first marketable product compromises the integrity of the formula.
Well, what about companies that sell on a delivered price basis and they pay for transportation? You don't include transportation. You deduct transportation costs from gross sales price, don't you?
Only certain kinds of transportation, Mr. Justice White.
The ones you don't make a profit on.
Well, essentially, if they're delivered over to a transporter, and it's the transporter's profit. That is an accommodation that the regulations make with respect to purchase.
So you do not include all elements of gross sales?
Well, that, as I understand it, is the only element of gross sales that is not included.
Why isn't it included?
It's not included, as
because
I understand.
Because the company doesn't make a profit on it.
No, because it's the transporter's profit.
Well, but so yes, I'm right. The company itself doesn't make a profit on it.
The company does not make a profit on transportation.
Well,
but it
didn't make any profit on its bagging?
I don't think we have to worry about that in this case because
I know you don't want to worry about it, but that's the very worry in the case.
No, it's not the very worry.
Well, it's one of them.
Well, no, it isn't, Mr. Justice White, and the reason it isn't is because because it's been stipulated in this case that the respondent realized a net profit on the sale of each bag of cement.
It is not stipulated that he made a profit on his bagging expense.
It is not stipulated that he made a profit.
As a matter of fact, the claim is that he loses.
That it costs him more to bag than he adds to the price from the bagging.
Yeah, yes, but the point of the proportion of profits method is that it has to measure the sales of a finished product. And part of this respondent, as well as all other cement integrated producers, sold bagged cement in response to a customer demand for cement in bags. And there is no suggestion here that, and it seems to me that the relevant fact is that this respondent earned a profit on each bag of cement that it sold. And once it is assumed that that is a profitable aspect of its business, all of that has to go into the equation.
Except transportation, because he doesn't make a profit on it.
Well, except transportation, because transportation basically is taken out of his hands and put into the hands of a transporter. And our point is with respect to transportation, and I know that the point is
that he doesn't make a profit out of it.
Exactly. But he did make a profit on the sale of bagged cement. And I think that makes all the difference in the world. The conditions of the regulation, the purchase transportation regulations, are set forth at page 13A of our appendix to our brief, and you can see that the conditions are very narrow. It says it's not transportation conducted by the taxpayer, but which is performed in conveyances owned or leased by persons other than the taxpayer, rather than conveyances owned or leased by the taxpayer, which are performed solely to deliver the taxpayer's minerals or mineral products to the customer rather than to transport such minerals or products for packaging or other additional processing, which are charged to the customers in such a way that the taxpayer does not ordinarily earn any profit with respect to such transportation. Now, that is the, and as I understand it, the only arguable exception to the integrity of the method, because the method demands that the method won't work with respect to carving out that aspect of gross income from mining unless the denominator in that fraction includes all of the costs and the multiplier includes the gross income from mining. And since this taxpayer sold cement in bags and charged a price for it, that whole price has to be included. Because if it isn't, you don't get, it's an approximated method, but the approximation, starts to depart from the intended ambit of the depletion allowance, which is to compensate for the exhaustion of the mineral deposit and not to compensate and not to provide any deduction for non-mining activity.
What if the taxpayer price list said, I'll sell cement to you either in bags or in gross for exactly the same price per hundred?
For exactly the same price per hundred, then I assume that people would either take it one way or another. That doesn't mean that the taxpayer is not making a profit. All it means is that he's selling bagged cement for less.
Mm-hmm. And so what if he had a price list that says, I'll sell you bulk cement for $2 and bagged cement for $2.10?
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't make any difference what his price list is or what the cost of bagging.
No, it doesn't make any. It does make it. In your example, it makes a difference. But the point is that his gross sale of his first marketable product in your latter example is either $2 or $2.10, and we assume
it wouldn't make any difference to your case if it were stipulated that the cost of bagging was 20 cents, would it?
It wouldn't make any difference to me that the cost of bagging, and in fact, it was, essentially there was a disparity between the bagging premium and the bagging cost in this case. But essentially, all that means is that he's selling the cement for less. I mean, we have to assume that this taxpayer sold bagged cement, and, the Third Circuit more or less inferred that in Whitehall, and there's an array of appellate authority that rejects the notion that you can simply say, well, the bagging aspects of this thing are just an entirely different business and that we're going to ignore them. Because the regulations provide, with explicit direction, that the first marketable product is cement, no matter how it's packaged, in either bulk or bag form. If I can refer the court to page 8A of our appendix, which says here the first marketable product means the product produced by the taxpayer as a result of the application of non-mining processes in the form or condition in which such product or products are first marketed in significant quantities by the taxpayers. And then with specific reference to the cement industry, they say here, for example, if a cement manufacturer sells his own finished cement of various types in bulk and bags and also sells concrete blocks or dry ready mix aggregates containing additives, the finished cement of various types in bulk and bags constitutes the first marketable product.
And your suggestion is that's a permissible construction of the statute.
Absolutely.
And that's
absolutely.
And if it isn't, you lose. But if it is, you should win.
I think we should win because the statute simply permits the commissioner to permits a reasonable allowance in all such cases to be made under regulations prescribed by the secretary or his delegate. Now, that's a very broad delegation. We view those regulations as legislative in type, and this court has held in cases which are legion that the commissioner's regulations are entitled to deference.
What is the source of the language, first marketable product?
I assume that the source of the first
is that in the regulations anywhere?
Yes.
Is it in the statute?
It is not in the statute, but I assume that the...
So the first marketable product is a product of the commissioner's mind?
Based upon his reading of this court's decision in Carrollton Sewer Pipe, which talked about commercially marketable product.
Well, isn't it a little strange to say that there are three products that are the first marketable product, even though bulk cement, you have to do something else to it to get it into bags?
Put it
and
in
the
bag.
You have to do something else to it to get it into the cement block.
Oh, yes.
And it costs you money to do it. And yet you say all three.
No. I, that's not what I said. The block is not the first marketable product.
You said it was.
No, I didn't. It says the finished cement of various types in bulk and bags constitutes the first marketable product. But the blocks and the aggregates and the sackcrete or whatever, that's a different product.
What about the bag cement? It costs him money. There's a whole another process to go through to put it in bags.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
And
why?
So how can there be two first marketable products?
Of course, there's only one first marketable product, cement, no matter how it's packaged.
I know, that's what you say.
Although, because in our view, bagging is not a chemical or a physical process that alters the character of the manufactured product. The manufactured product is Portland cement. Whether it's in a railroad car, the Fifth Circuit stated this with excruciating detail, whether it's in a railroad car or a piggyback or whatever, it's still cement.
Is that consistent with the Tenth Circuit's opinion of 14A of the petition down towards the bottom where the court there says the government seeks to have, quote, bagged cement, close quote, be the, quote, first marketable product and to so include the expenses associated with the bag? Did the government take the same position?
That's really a mischaracterization of the government's position. The government argues that the first marketable product is finished cement, no matter how it's packaged. And reading this most charitably, I would assume that what the court meant is that the government seeks to have bag cement included in the first marketable product because it's the same cement. It's simply put in a bag.
One answer might be that the reason you're here is because the Tenth Circuit, from your point of view, did not understand the case.
I think that's right. I mean, the Tenth Circuit took the position that bulk cement was the first product and bag cement was the second product. But the putting something in a bag is not the chemical or physical processing that the court in Carrollton adverted to when it tried to fix the cutoff point as to when mining stops and when manufacturing begins. And, you know, put the bagging is clearly part of the manufacturing cost, but it goes into the sales of what this respondent and all other integrated producers sell as the first marketable product.
May I ask you a question prompted by some of Mr. Justice White's questions? As I understand your position, as a matter of fact, you contend that the taxpayer actually made a profit on the bagged cement.
Yes.
They wouldn't sell it otherwise.
Yes.
But the profit on the bagged cement is less than the profit on the other cement because the bags are more costly than the bagging premium. But is it not true that in your analysis of the case, even if they lost money on the bagging, the bagged cement, say the bags were so terribly expensive, they packed them up in Christmas packages or something, they lost money on the bags, but you'd still make the same position.
Sure, it would have to be included in the gross sales of the first marketable product, and then it would be, you know, it may affect the amount of depletion allowance.
From your point of view, it's just as if they maybe had a price cut during February
sure.
and they lost money for three
sure.
or 4 weeks. You'd still use the same basic ingredients.
Exactly. And the suggestion that the argument that I'm making is simply not one that's based upon regulations that we contend deserve great deference as legislative regulations. The court has held in a variety of depletion cases that the commissioner has special powers in the depletion area because the legislative authority delegated to him is so broad, but the respondent is faced with an array of appellate decisions in which the court below stands as the sole exception that the first marketable product in this area is bulk and bag cement, that is finished cement. I would like, since the second question is a subsidiary one, and I assume that costs necessarily include in the denominator flow from the first question I would like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Well, just one more question. Is your case really boiled down and perhaps oversimplified something like the difference between buying a loaf of bread in Paris where you put it under your arm and buying one at the supermarket here where it's all wrapped up in a package?
Exactly. It's the same bread. And if there are tax deductions that or a computation that flow from that involve gross sales, if the supermarket in the United States has to raise the price to take into account the bag, or if it doesn't, that those sales have to be included in gross sales.
Very well.
And I would like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Bedell.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The question in this case seems to have been cast in terms of preserving the integrity of a mathematical, automatically functioning formula, rather than in terms of preserving the integrity of the purpose for which that formula is being applied. The purpose is to ascertain an integrated miner's gross income for mining.
Well, let me put it, I'm alternately confused and find the case simplified. When and what is it that can be first be sold? What can first be sold here?
Bulk cement.
Yeah.
And bulk cement.
Is the case any more complicated than that?
Not really. That is the product that is sold in a substantial quantity. And indeed, as the Tenth Circuit has correctly recognized, bagging is something that occurs additionally, and it has a discrete income component.
Well, this sounds as though you agree with Mr. Smith.
Which I do not agree with Mr. Smith.
It sounds as though you do, though.
No,
you say bag cement is not one of the first marketable products.
I certainly do, because bulk cement is sold in significant quantities.
More bulk than bag.
Indeed, approximately 95% in bulk, which is the first product reached.
Suppose there were more in bags than in bulk, only 1% of bulk. Would your position here be exactly the same?
No, it would not, because you have to have sufficient sales to establish the price so that you have a meaningful first marketable product. Just as in the case of a representative field price, where the product is sold after mining ends.
Where is that line of demarcation, 50%, 40%?
Cases in the depletion area under the representative market or field price generally have found that 10, 15, 20%. It has to be determined with reference to the realities of the market.
What do you want it to be included in your gross sales figure, the multiplier? You just want your gross sales of bulk cement in that or not?
The sales figure should include the gross sales of bulk cement and the sales value of the cement which is sold in bags, because that also is the product of cement rock which was mined by the taxpayer and manufactured into finished cement.
So you say along with Mr. Smith then that you include in the sales figure the cement sold in bags.
You have to include an income figure for cement sold in bags, and the proportionate profit formula contemplates this because it takes actual sales of the first marketable product, sales of cement in bulk, and with respect to products that are second or third, a further processed or product after first marketable product, they take a constructive sales value derived from the sales value applied to the first marketable product.
The word process. What was the process in putting it in the bag?
It is the activity of putting it into a bag, Mr. Justice Marshall.
It's not process, is
it? Not in the sense usually used in the depletion area. It is not.
Mr. Beadle, on the portion of the gross sales that represent product that was bagged, what is the constructive sales price that the taxpayer contended for? Is it the equivalent of the unbagged cement, or is it the actual price less the bagging cost?
The taxpayer took the less favorable position, namely less favorable to itself, of the actual sales price less the bagging cost, because in this case, as the court has noted, the bagging cost exceeded the bag premium, the additional revenue generated by selling the cement in bags rather than in bulk. And so a taxpayer took sales figure of cement sold in bags, reduced that by the cost of bagging, which was greater, really, than the additional income generated by it, and put that in the sales figure that then was allocated in accordance with the proportionate profits formula.
Doesn't seem to me that's consistent with your basic position that the sales cost is the cost of the unbagged cement. I mean, the sales price is the price of the unbagged cement. May have been good tactics to do it that way, because I see what you're saying, but it's somewhat inconsistent.
The taxpayer was following the law as had been set forth by the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in 1968 in the Ideal Basic case, when it interpreted the manner in which the proportionate profits formula functioned in the case of a cement manufacturer.
Do you agree, by the way, that the government's position is the one that the regulation commands, and so you must attack the regulation?
No, I do not agree with that. It seems to us that there is, within the regulation, room to find a result which is consistent with the purpose of the regulation. The language Mr. Smith read to us, which said that the bulk and packaged products are considered to be essentially the same product. It doesn't say they are. It says they're considered to be. That is language of presumption, not language of absoluteness. And when a result occurs under regulatory language that clearly is at conflict with the purpose of the language, then it seems to me that this language is susceptible of being interpreted in a manner that as to cure the distortion which will result under Mr. Smith's interpretation. And indeed, I think that distortion should be focused on, because it is material to realize the manner in which the purpose of the applying the formula is being frustrated. And let us return momentarily. The purpose is to determine the gross income for mining. That is the value of the taxpayer's mineral that could have been realized had it been sold after mining processes end. So we're looking to a market value for the raw mineral product. That's the purpose for which the formula is being applied.
And when did the process end, in your view?
The mining process ends at the point of kill feed. When that is introduced into the kill, there is no dispute between the government and the taxpayer with respect to that. But the taxpayer's cement rock, under the government's interpretation, would have one value if that cement rock was manufactured into finished cement and sold as bulk cement. But a different value, the same identical mineral, would have a different value if it was manufactured into finished cement and sold in bags. Or looked at differently, if in a given year the taxpayer sold 5% of its cement rock in the form of finished cement in bags, the cement rock on an overall basis would have one value. The next year it sells 20% in bags, and the same cement rock from the same quarry, assume the same economic conditions, drops in value. On the other hand, if it went down to zero instead of the 7% it had here, the cement rock changes value. Now, this is the identical mineral, which under the government's theory is having a change in value because of this bagging activity, an activity which occurs after all mining and all manufacturing processes have been completed.
My brother Blackman's question, what if your client sold all the cement in bags and always had and always will?
If all the cement were sold in bags, bag cement would be the first marketable product. Because what is being looked to...
Bagging would clearly be part of
it. And bagging would be part of the cost in arriving at that.
Right.
Because what is being looked to is what is the point in the activity of getting to market when the taxpayer...
And what if a competitor sold all the cement in bulk? The difference of the mined product would be different between the two companies, wouldn't it?
Under the proportionate profits formula, yes.
And to carry it one step further, what if the industry as a whole sold largely or totally in bulk, and this one manufacturer sold it just in bags?
There would be, because of the manner in which the formula, mathematical formula, operates, there would be a different result. Now, the question is, in this case, there are actual facts.
Right.
There are actual facts which can be looked to avoid what is an unrealistic result from the application of mechanical formula. And that really is the question. Can actual facts be taken into account? The bagging costs and the amount of additional income, because it is clear on the record that the taxpayer realized a certain increment of revenue when it sold cement in bags rather than in bulk, an additional amount of revenue.
How is that different from, say, you have three or four methods of sale, some you sell through distributors and some on commission and some through door-to-door salesmen, and there are different sales costs for 10% of your business and another 20 and another 50, but it's still all cement. Would you, and as those proportions varied from year to year, the value of the mine product would also vary from year to year, as I suppose. Would you say that nevertheless those are, would you say that's all one marketable product, or does it change from time to time? Say it was, none of it was in bags, but some of it was sold in smaller quantities at somewhat different prices because different sales techniques.
Some through jobbers.
How is that any different than the bagging problem?
It seems to me it's different in two reasons, because in the first, there may be sales much closer to the manufacturing plant itself. And so as they're moved away from that.
Well, I'm leaving out transportation costs. I'm just focusing on sales costs.
The other thing is that sales costs are costs which a number of the courts that have looked at it, the lower courts, have decided are costs applicable both to the mining and the manufacturing activity.
Well, that's exactly they say the bags are allocated to both, too.
They allocate them. Well, the government, though, under its interpretation of the formula, would allocate the cost of bagging solely to the manufacturing, non-mining side.
Well, Mr. Bazell,
it goes into the total figure, doesn't it? just as the sales costs go into the total figure. Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought...
Well, the manner in
say
which...
Say you have a general sales manager. What happens to his salary?
The salary of a general sales manager should be treated as both in the numerator of the formula and in the denominator.
Is that what you did in your tax return?
Again, following the Tenth Circuit. The Tenth Circuit's interpretation...
Wait, yes or no? Did you or did you not?
No, because that is not the manner in which the Tenth Circuit interpreted.
If one reads the statutory language itself, the 611A, the general rule, in talking about mines, it says that the allowance for depletion for depreciation improvements according to the peculiar conditions in each case, such reasonable allowance in all cases to be made under regulations prescribed by the Secretary or his delegate. Is it conceivable, in view of that reference to peculiar cases, that the numerator, denominator were worked out by the Secretary could itself be unreasonable in some cases?
Exactly. Exactly. It is contemplated by the statute not only by the language that it be reasonable, but that it take into account the variations in different cases. Obviously, administrative convenience and simplicity require ignoring some variations. But when you have variations that are supported by definite facts, such as in this case, peculiar circumstances, is what we have here, an ascertainable income item, an ascertainable cost associated with the bagging activity, then that is the type of case which it should be dealt with. And indeed, that is what the Tenth Circuit has consistently held. It's the Ideal Basic case in 1968, the Portland Cement Company of Utah case in 1969, and then in this case. Because of this actual fact, it is a factor which can be taken into account and supports the determination, as the Tenth Circuit has held, that the first marketable product is cement in bulk. The confusion between the premise of the proportionate profits formula and the purpose which it serves of trying to find gross income from mining has clouded the issue in many the contexts it's been looked at up to now. There is distortion which occurs if additional processes farther away from the crude mineral product which is being valued are taken into account. The Tenth Circuit realized that, and the Tenth Circuit, because it realized that the purpose of the proportionate profits formula is to value the mineral product, found the place closest to the mine, closest to the point where the mineral product is, and that is cement in bulk, and treated that as the first marketable product, so that it was the starting point for the application of this mathematical formula to ascertain the market value. It did away with the recognized distorting effects which occur if additional activities on which a profit is not earned are included in the computation. In the same manner as the regulations explicitly recognize with respect to purchase transportation by common carrier to the customer, to deliver the material to the customer, is specifically excluded. Why? Because there is a reason. It is not reasonable to presume that the miner earns a profit on the transportation because the carrier earns it. The evidence of a tariff demonstrates that. Here, the facts, the evidence of the bagging premium and the bagging cost demonstrate that it is not appropriate to attribute any further profit to the bagging activity. And so the Tenth Circuit excluded that from the computation in a similar manner by its determination that the first marketable product is cement in bulk. The result of making the proportionate profits method work in the best manner it can to serve its purpose can be accomplished, as the Tenth Circuit did, or by finding implicit in the regulatory language flexibility to make its application a reasonable one, one consistent with the actual facts. I thank the Court.
Very well. Mr. Smith, do you have anything further?
I think that the respondent's emphasis on actual facts is belied by the provisions of the regulations, which provide that if the commissioner may determine that a method of computation is more appropriate than the proportionate profits method or the method being used by the taxpayer, and that the taxpayer can request such a determination of an alternative method. Here the taxpayer has, because of its integrated status and the absence of a representative field price, has invoked the proportionate profits method of computing its gross income from mining. It hasn't sought to bring any actual facts to the commissioner before going into this litigation. The proportionate profits method provides in detail the language I read to the court about a cement manufacturer. When we talk about the flexibility of the regulations provide at page 21A of our appendix with precise reference to this case. If a cement manufacturer, et cetera, there is no room for any flexible reading. What the respondent seeks in this case is nothing less than an invalidation of these regulations, which three courts of appeals have approved and which the court below stands in sole and persistent invalidation of, and there is no way that one can read these regulations in a flexible way to take account of what respondent seeks in this case, which in our view is nothing less than an expanded depletion allowance that would include part of its non-mining income. The cost ratio method is indeed an approximation, but it is an approximation which is designed to take into account the fact that each dollar of costs produces a proportionate amount of gross sales.
Well, that in itself is something of a fiction.
Well, of course it's a fiction, but it's an approximation, right, which is based upon the fact that there's no really better way to do it. And regulations like that, the choice that the commissioner makes in areas like a technical area like depletion and in other areas of the code, have been consistently upheld by this court the courts as basically.
And your point is that this taxpayer elected to
elected the proportionate profits method, and you can't simply elect parts of the proportionate profits method. Putting cement in a bag is, in our view and in the view of the regulations, not processing. It doesn't alter the character of the cement. The cement, whether it's in a tank car or whether it's in a bag, is still Portland cement. That was the respondent's first marketable product, and it's the gross sales of those things. If the taxpayer had sold Portland cement at a great killing, at a very high price, it would still be in gross sales, and there was, you know, it may produce some variations or some distortions, or if the market goes down, it would still be in gross sales. And the fact that it sought to satisfy a particular kind of demand of small customers in the construction industry for 94-pound bags of cement, that was part of its business. And if it's part of its business,
you say for the same reason the sales expense after bagging is included.
The sales expense after bagging to get it to the customer is goes into the denominator. Exactly. Exactly. And for all those purposes, we think the judgment should be reversed.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
John Fortunato.